Well, thanks again, Mark. Wonderful session on mentoring that we've just had. And I know for myself, I just written so many notes, just taking in so much of what you said. And I think there's a lot of really good that is for our own lives, but also really good in terms of what's preachable, I'll say, that's good for our congregation to hear as well. This is not something that we need to do on our own. This is a big topic for our congregations. So I'm just going to ask a couple of questions. And first one is this: what did you hear from Mark that was surprising or encouraging to you today?
Mark, I loved your analogy with the Monty Python, because I think those three questions are so powerful, and the way that you interpreted them to really get at the heart of really mentoring and caring for people. I just found that so helpful. So thank you.
Yeah, I just a quick note about that is, exploring the identity and calling are, I think, maybe missed in we had a question in the seminar about why businesses and marketplace organizations are maybe getting more traction than church in this. And one of the possible reasons is that those deeper works of mentoring around identity and really why are you here may be bypassed as we sort of go after more of the knowledge and the skill stuff. So that to me is so foundational. You know, what is your name? What is your quest? Who are you?
You know, for me, I think, you know, in pastoral ministry, so much of it can become about trying to get people to do things, trying to get stuff from people in order to accomplish the work that you're doing together. So, you know, the vision that you kind of presented today for mentoring, which was about kind of pouring into people's lives, helping them become who it is that that God wants you, or God wants them to become, was so encouraging and helpful, just to have that clarified again, that so much of our role is to do that. But just the reminder too of the investment of time that takes. This is not a sprint. This is this is marathon work. And when you're working in Sunday to Sunday world, you know, to be thinking this way was really refreshing.
Thank you so much, Rob. You know, I did a lecture at Regent College around a year after I left pastoral ministry. It might have been even less than a year. And I called it, I've been meaning to tell you this. And the subtitle was Confessions of an Ex-Pastor. And we packed the place out because that just sounds so juicy. But really, it was more a confession of some of the ways I felt I missed things that, now that I was out of pastoral ministry, I saw more clearly. And one of them is exactly what you said, that I think when I was pastoring, a lot of my mentoring was deeply transactional. If I come alongside that person, I'll have some uber good leader. Whereas part of the gift of not being in pastoral ministry is I don't have a cat in the fight or dog in the fight or, you know, a personal stake in it, other than this father heart that I began with, to really want to see the flourishing of this person for their own sake, for the kingdom's sake. And I cannot tell you how liberating that's been. If I ever go back into pastoral ministry, which is my age growing increasingly unlikely, and this is one of the things I confessed in this lecture, I would, my eye would be on the sparrow. I would not break the bruised reed, and I would not snuff out the guttering wick. I would be attentive to those people that nobody's noticing, nobody's coming alongside of, but you can develop, you can find a deep father's heart for and begin to sort of pour something into them. It'll be probably a longer investment of time, and maybe you're never going to get, you know, the next board member, but I think it's deeply gratifying to the heart of God. And I think that's really what Jesus did. The one, you know, it's often been pointed out, the one kind of crackerjack in the sort of mix was Judas. He seemed to have all the leadership skills, whereas, you know, these other guys just bumbling around and doing stuff. So anyhow, I wish I'd done more of that or had that perspective when I was in pastoral ministry, but I'm glad you picked that out.
And I would say as well, thank you, Mark. On a related note to what you just said, one of the things that I found most encouraging, pleasantly surprising, would be your touch on the doctrine of adoption. When you're talking about the deep work of mentoring, and you just mentioned it again, more or less, that fatherly heart from Romans chapter 8, one of my favorite passages, and that doctrine of adoption and how that relates to mentoring. And I just found that very, very encouraging.
Thanks so much, Evan. You know, I've been thinking more and more. I have a good dear friend in England who adopted this past, I think about 3 or 4 years ago, three girls from all siblings, but these three girls from a very broken home. Mm-hmm. And it's been quite a ride for them. But he wrote a book, a beautiful book called The Road to Adoption. And I, since that, and I've spent some time helping them kind of think through that book, I've been so taken by that in some ways, you know, that the heart of God to adopt us is maybe the more profound understanding of the Father heart, the choosing of this one, the choosing and desiring the flourishing of somebody that I don't necessarily have genetic or biological stakes in. It's very easy for me to want my biological children to flourish. But we actually have a growing vision, my wife and I. We had a young Indigenous girl live with us for part of a year that we're still connected with. But she has just so many obstacles to her flourishing. And she's broken her heart over and over and over again. And we became legal guardians, but we would have adopted her if that was on the table. And I realized that we were tapping into some part of us that so longed for her to, and still longs. I mean, again, we're still in connection with her. And so what's grown out of that is my wife and I, our retirement dream, you know, I'm 60 and I should be dreaming of golf courses and stuff. Our retirement dream is to find some property somewhere and have a community of 4 to 6 Indigenous girls living with us who, and honestly, you don't give an Indigenous girl anything. You just take obstacles away. But my mother who passed away in October, I can still hear her voice calling, you know, telling me, Mark, why do you want to, you know, do this crazy thing when you're in your 60s? You should retire like normal people. But I think it's, you know, it's coming back to this, somehow God's kind of stirred up in us this this heart of adoption.
Yeah, apparently that was a common theme because for me, it was right at the very start when you talked about the mothering and fathering heart. And I think your phrase was this deep desire to see their flourishing in maturity. That is a stark reminder for all of us in pastoral ministry that in large ways, that's really what we've been called to is that deep desire to see the people that we work with in our ministries flourish in their maturity.
It's so all over. I mean, Paul uses mother image, father image. I'm in birth pains until Christ is formed in you. He doesn't care. He'll just pull on that language any way he can get it. And I think, I haven't done a study, and maybe one of you have done, but more and more as God's cultivating that heart of me, I'm more and more convinced that might be one of the deep secrets to Paul's theology, is the father heart primarily understood as adoption. Romans 8, as you pointed out, that's really the deep work, and that's a chapter that's almost like canon within the canon. Like if you want to understand a whole bunch of theology and the character of God, it's not a bad place to keep sort of refracting whatever you understand through Romans 8. And what's at the heart of it is that we're adopted. And I think Paul never got over that. Right. We don't know anything about Paul, his parents and his relationship. And partly when it's not being mentioned, you want to be careful about, you know, making speculation, but the likelihood is there weren't much there. And so some of his rigidity and anger and whatnot may have stemmed from, this is sheer conjecture, but the fact that nothing is on the record in terms of, you know, never what, you know, I think what my papa said to me or whatever, right? And so there's a sense that there seems to be that lacunae, this absence in his life that I think he never, ever, ever got over God saying, you're my son. I think he just never, and the Spirit testifying with his spirit that he is a child, the Son of God. I think in my the book I wrote on David, part of the difficulty of transposing, you know, the historical biblical material into fiction is fiction always has to have the your character has to have some deep quest, and it's even better if they don't know what it is. So nobody will keep reading a book if they don't sense your character searching for something they know not what, but it's explaining and driving everything. And so I had to keep going back and saying, what is it? I don't think the deep quest of David is he wanted to be king. The deep quest of David is he wanted dad. And Jesse was, is by all appearances, a rather, you know, dismissive. Some rabbis even speculated that David was a bastard because of the seeming wall of indifference between and the cruelty of the brothers toward David. Who knows? But then, if you look at the Saul story, the language of son father, or Saul flipping back to son of Jesse when he's angry at David, it's extraordinary. And so I think that one of the things that was you know, so exciting for David and then deeply tragic is I think he was looking for the father in Saul. And it also would partly explain why David was a crappy father himself. He was indulgent, but really didn't know how to parent anybody. But the other thing is that I think then his relationship with God is this healing of the father wound. And this connecting in ways that are stunning to us that nobody's demonstrated up until there. It's very New Testament, you know, the Abba. It's very much a spirit kind of infused love and seeking and comforting, seeking the comfort and the presence of the Father in God. We don't see that again until Jesus. And I think that it was in many ways his a nurturing of that relationship with God. It was a healing of the daddy wound. So whatever that may be, I really think this is, you know, some of the deep stuff in us. And by the way, in mentoring, a lot of people will seek out a mentor and they may not know again the quest that they're on, but the quest that they're on is that maybe some of the deficiencies of the relationship or disappointments of the relationship with the father, they at least in kind of in a deep intuitive way kind of want you to be that person. So I've been more and more, especially you get to an age, you know, where you can do this unabashedly, kind of step into the father role. And I more and more have taken on young women to mentor. If you want to talk about that, we can. But it's only something I've done recently, as most of these women, I could be not only their father, but their grandfather at this point. And so I am very, very intentional in my own head, but also even in how I frame the mentorship that I'll be kind of a father, grandfather to you if I can.
Mark, can you unpack that a little bit? Because that was one of my questions I had, and maybe Colin, we're jumping in too soon. But I was really curious for you to talk a little bit about that, with mentorship being male to male, female to female, and not male to female or female to male. So you've just touched on a little bit. So would you unpack that a little bit more for me?
Sure, absolutely. First of all, obviously, there's all of the cautions that we would bring into that. And one of the ways I've managed that all through, even with now that I'm an old man, but I always get my wife in on it. So she always knows I'm meeting with so-and-so, not necessarily what we've talked about. But I always make sure that before I enter into that mentorship, my wife has got, we've had the person over and had a meal with them. Often they're married women, so we bring the husband over and they have kids and whatnot. So we really kind of set it in that context that this is I'm married, you're married, whatever. And when I've spent time, I talked about this young Vietnamese woman. Cheryl's met her several times, has grown much from her faith as I have. But whenever I have a time with her, I'll say to my wife, I've got, you know, this Zoom call planned. And then I'll again give her not the details, but wow, that was really great. And she's, you know, dealing with some stuff in her church or whatever. So just that accountability piece. But here's the thing. I did, when the Me Too movement really hit, I was part of a panel at my university on, you know, Q&A with students around this. And one of the people who I was on a panelist is a very sharp woman who, sharp in terms of bright, a lawyer. And she works, she worked with IJM, International Justice Mission, as a lawyer, and now she's on staff with us. And she was asked about this sort of caution now that had entered the workplace around men in law firms and businesses, et cetera, no longer willing to mentor young women. And she decried it. She's a full womanist or feminist, but she said, I cannot imagine being where I am if men hadn't been willing to come alongside and mentor me. And she identified this, and I think it's true in the church, that more and more we're seeing women rise into these roles that traditionally, conventionally have been the domain of men. So senior pastor, preaching pastor, elder, lawyers, whatever it happens to be. And she said, I have been mentored well by women, but the reality is men have more experience than most women I know. And she said, I would hate if we got to a place where, and she actually said this, where a senior or lead pastor was not, because of these rules we'd set up, was not able to come alongside a female associate pastor at a gift of preaching or leadership and not nurture that. So that I'd already got into the game on that one, but I thought absolutely right. So I would advocate not we have some strict policy that will never happen, that we just are really wise and have really good protocols and parameters around it. But I think we're depriving ourselves too. I can also think of the women, as I mentioned, this Vietnamese, but I've mentored a lot of women, especially in the last 7 years. And oh my goodness, I have had, it has had such a transforming effect in my own life and faith. You may know the research work of Carol Gilligan, a famous woman who worked with one of I'm forgetting, but a famous psychologist who was studying moral philosophy. And she noticed partway through, she was a TA, but it was all male people that he was working with. And she began to wonder, what if you threw a woman in this conversation about morality? And it totally changed the conversation. And broadly, and to generalize, Carol Gilligan found that in the conversations up to that point, morality was about, you know, here's the right and wrong, here's the rules. Once you brought women in the conversation, morality also was about relationship. Totally changed. And that's been, you know, I've had those kind of revelatory moments where we're talking about, say, a biblical text or something in a way I've read it. I always read the Bathsheba text as she was complicit. Talk to a wised up woman who's a good exegete on that, and you will get you'll get a whole different take on that story.
That's very helpful, Mark. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, let's kind of dive into some questions. I mean, each of you have your own different ministry context that you're in. You know, some in local church. Terry, you're in a little different context now of ministry and in the stage that you're at in life. But you all have these ministry contexts. And here you have Mark, who's just brought this session on mentoring before us. And so if you had the opportunity, which you do now, to ask Mark a question around, you know, mentoring that could impact how and what you're doing with mentorship in your own context. Ask away.
Yeah, I'll jump right in there first on this one. My ministry context, I'm a pastor of an old established church in Berwick, Nova Scotia. Been around since 1828, so it's a pretty old church. It's a church that, in all fairness, has dwindled in numbers over the years. And thinking about it kind of as a church in the context of a revitalization, really. And so we have predominantly an elderly congregation. And so I, as the pastor, would be quite a bit younger than a lot of the members. And so as I hear talk about mentoring, I often think about it as, you know, someone a bit older, kind of further down the line, mentoring someone younger. And so what would be your suggestions, pointers to how mentoring could be brought into a context such as mine, particularly the question of age as well?
Evan, such a good question. I would again point out the very fine resource by Carson Pugh called Mentoring Leaders. And he has a grid or a quadrant or something where he talks about these various mentoring relationships we have. And one of them is exactly what you talked about, where the age differential might be atypical or unconventional. I'm, you know, that you're the younger person mentoring somebody 20, 30 years older. And so he has a lot of wisdom around that. So I would point that out. But, you know, when I first started mentoring, I was the young guy, hard to believe looking at me now. And I more and more was approached by men in their 60s, 70s, et cetera, often, interestingly, who had a father wound or father deficit. And weirdly saw me even at 30 something, 40 something as kind of, and again, maybe didn't explicitly, though a couple times I remember them actually saying how weird it was, but they felt I was like the father they never had.
Yes.
But I think that was really intuitively what they're looking for, is somebody to speak the kind of affirmation, you are my son whom I love, with you I'm well pleased. And really establish their identity in that, that I become the refraction point or the embodiment of the love of God and the pleasure of God toward them. And I, as one of my favorite ones with Dave, a man named Dave, I'll just kind of call him Dave, but he's still alive. He's now 98. And I led him to faith when he was 78. And baptized him the next week. He was supposed to die. He was in the hospital dying. And I, one of the few times I prayed and actually saw a healing. And so 20 years later, he's going strong. He was a complete atheist and had the privilege of leading him to faith. Well, he had no experience in the Christian faith. And I was, at that point when I led him to faith, so I would be 40 years old, and he was 78. And we had a magnificent relationship. And obviously, one of the ways I entered it is, you have life experience. You lived through a war. You've been married to the same woman for 50-something years, and it's a good, good marriage. Even when you're a raging atheist, you were a good husband. And so I came in a spirit of humility and opened myself to the things that I needed from him. But he hadn't cracked the Bible in his whole life. And he was hungry. And so anyhow, I just was able to really pass on. But the root was is establishing him in this identity. He was an orphan. He had an orphan, talk about adoption. He was an orphan in all senses of the word. And to kind of help him overcome that orphan spirit and orphan mentality was glorious. I love him. He's one of the few people when I go back to the island I'll connect with, you know, sort of going on the sly now. And there's a whole bunch of people I'm happy not to see, but Dave always.
Oh, that's great. Thank you.
You're welcome.
So I was pastoring for 35 years and retired just last October. And so, Mark, I'm even older than you, as you know. So I kind of fell into the mentoring thing in kind of an interesting way years ago, and you probably know this better than I do, Mark, but I was taught that every pastor should have a Paul, a Timothy, and a Barnabas in their life.
Right.
And so I started to live by that principle, where I would seek out, when I would go into a church as a pastor, I would seek out a Paul, find somebody. And generally I tried to find somebody outside the church who was older, wiser, down the road, that could kind of mentor me and care for me and allow me to grow in my walk. And then I always continued to pray and ask God to bring a Timothy into my life, someone I could mentor, someone younger, like you said, not necessarily age-wise, but younger in the faith and kind of mentor along the way. And then I always wanted to have, usually I ended up with a number of Barnabases. My wife, Brenda, has been my Barnabas for, well over 40 years now. And so that's certainly been my encourager. But there's other people that I found that I needed in pastoral ministry that just come alongside me and encourage me. So now I find myself retired. I've got a little company going called, I do some consulting with churches, but it's interesting. I'm trying to mentor younger people, younger pastors in particular, because I'm a little bit like you, Mark. I'm now retired. I'm sorry, I have to confess, I do enjoy golf, so I am getting some golf in. But that's not my main goal. My main goal is to keep giving back to the kingdom. And so I'm very privileged, even though it's only been a little over a year, I'm retired, to be able to come alongside and mentor some pastors. And I mean, obviously with COVID hitting, it kind of dried up, but I'm still open to doing that and kind of working them. And something that you said, I think, is so key, and I'm so glad you brought it up, was the whole idea of if they have a teachable spirit. And I've tried to mentor some, and I'm like you, who just didn't have a teachable spirit. And I found that very frustrating, and I just felt it wasn't a good fit. But boy, when you find someone that has a teachable spirit, what a joy it is to be able to walk alongside them. And so I feel I'm in a wonderful time in my life where I can try to give back a little bit because God has blessed us so much.
Terry, that's such a great portrait of your life. Now, I disc golf because I don't play it. And when I did, I was horrible at it. my indulgence is riding a motorcycle, which is sacred. So just let's not touch that. But I actually like that tidy little schemata that the Paul, the Barnabas, the Timothy. Partly because it really does limb these varying dimensions, and not every mentoring relationship is equal. And a lot of them are these Barnabas, they're side by side. There's a kind of a lateral quality or a horizontal quality that I'm not mentoring up, which is, what Evan talked about. There's somebody who maybe is older than me, or maybe even in a leadership role that is over me, but I need to kind of influence your life in some ways. We're mentoring down the Timothy. But the Barnabas things are huge. And here's an interesting thing. More and more as I'm finding, first of all, I'm kind of tapped out. I've got, this is about a dozen people I'm currently mentoring, and that's pretty much my, my bandwidth. So when people approach me, I'll either just say, I don't think I can do a decent job at this. So I am more and more declining, but not because I feel the person is unworthy or I don't believe in them, but I just don't want to get into something and fail them. But more and more, if it's somebody that I feel, man, this could be a great friendship though, or Barnabas relationship, I'll say, I don't really want to get into official mentoring thing with you, but if you'd like to get together once a week or once every month or 6 weeks, go for a walk, go for a cup of coffee and talk about life and ministry and everything, I'm in. Mm. And so they often have some classic mentoring dimensions, but I've taken the weight off of them and me that we have to make that official and shape it that way. So I forgot that whole Barnabas, Paul, Timothy thing, but that would really be, I may be trying to collect more Barnabases in my life these days.
Well, it's interesting, Mark, if you recall, you were very influential out west when you were pastoring with your cluster that you had out there. Because when I first met you, it was through Gary Nelson. And it was as a result of that that we got started, and with Rob Nyland's big help and so many others, we got Cavendish 250 going here on the East Coast. And it's still going strong, thanks to Rob and other people at our convention. But that really is a Barnabas group that is there to encourage. And I know the time that I spent with Cavendish 250 was such a big help for me. And Rob, I hope and pray it's still going strong.
Mark, I'm just curious, just kind of practically speaking, if you were like sitting looking at your week, how much time when you were pastoring would you give to mentoring?
Yeah, I mean, I've tended to organize my time in big blocks and try to be flexible about it, that I don't get so locked in that, I'm raging if something has to be moved around. But I, the things that matter to me, I try to set aside, chunks of time every week. So I would say the mentoring piece is probably averages out to about 2 to 3 hours a week. And then if I have these dozen, I'm obviously not meeting with them every week, but it allows me to kind of navigate that without feeling overwhelmed by, that task or that responsibility. One of the things when I first came here, it was like a mad rush to get, and partly because I'm a bit known through various channels and circles. So suddenly I had all these younger pastors mostly lining up to get me to mentor them. And I felt I had a lot of time on my hands because, I just changed jobs. And by the way, being a professor has no bearing and no similarities to being a pastor insofar as they don't care where you are as long as you show up for your, 6 hours a week or whatever. And then they don't really care. So see how that works in your day job. But so I felt that is all this time on my hand. And so I said yes to a lot of these requests and then suddenly felt, oh my goodness, I've overcommitted. And after about a year or so with a bunch, I did some discernment that these six or eight people would really click well together. So I invited them into a mentoring group. And that, with some variation, we've added a few people, it didn't work for them. But there's six of us now, and that's more longstanding. That's been going now for 4 years. We're trying to plan a retreat in January, but COVID might interfere with that. But we have really built a really phenomenal relationship that it's a lot of the Barnabas thing. There's a lot of sort of co-mentoring that goes on. And I'm just, actually, I invited, when I did that, another guy about my age, who's a pastor, but also oversees a denomination. It's a small denomination. And so, do you want to saddle up with these young bucks and kind of be old men of the tribe or whatever? So we hang out with them and less do we even talk. Like we sit and kind of fly in the wall thing. And then once in a while they ask, one of the old gunslingers, one of these old men, what we know. And we kind of show them a few tricks with guns and stuff. And then we holster it again and leave them to it. But it's just a ton of fun. And we our normal way of connecting, if the weather's on, is we'll go for a 3-4 hour hike and we'll get up at the top of some summit. I'm right near the mountains and we'll make a fire and we'll do some roast some smokies. And then, there's usually, I actually asked one of these younger guys to start leading it. So he'll have one question and we'll start working through that. So it's really awesome. But that's partly how I've managed the time. That was a long answer to say, I didn't think I could adequately give one-on-one time to all those people. And I thought they would make a great community and start kind of pouring into each other's life. So now there's all these little circles in that. So I find out when we get together, these guys, had a problem. And one phoned up the other to say, what would you do with the board that's gone rogue or whatever? So they're not even looking to the two old men anymore. We're just there for the backdrop.
Well, I mean, that story is helpful to me because I've kind of thought of mentoring as there's capital M mentoring, kind of what you shared with us at the masterclass. Yeah. And then I've kind of thought of like small M mentoring, which is getting four or five guys together for an evening around a fire, because I'm just seeing the 20 to 30 somethings in particular are so hungry for input, direction. There's a real hunger about what's it look like. I think of the line from the John Mayer song, am I living it right? Am I doing this right in life? And so I just see such a need for that. And I'm trying to think, is there ways to do this in smaller groups of 4 to 5 at a time where we kind of journey together for a year? And
Rob, I'm thinking that's a more and more sort of winsome model. I also do something many of you will know, Doug Ward. And so we started a mentoring group that meets, we do Zoom stuff. And then once a year, we had to cancel this year for obvious reasons, but once a year we meet for a week at Barnabas and it's six guys and we go for a whole week and man, it's like unbelievably deep. And I honestly think that everybody, including the so-called mentors, gets more out of that than sometimes this one-on-one thing where we can tap out pretty quick. Like I there's lots of times I'm doing the big M mentoring, and like I have to call uncle or tap the mat or whatever and say, I have no idea what you're talking about or how to solve that. So whereas if it's a group thing, it's incredible how much wisdom there is in the group.
Mark, in the class earlier on, you talked about kind of diving into the thorn in the flesh and I think you worded it, identifying the nevertheless.
Yeah.
Theoretically, those are great, but in order for that to truly happen, there has to be a, like really just a sense of security and safety within that conversation and within that relationship. So how do you see that getting developed in the context? Because sometimes, you know, if for a pastor, there may be a person in their setting who, you know, as pastors, you're going, gee, you know, I'm not sure how safe I am in this setting to share, so I can't necessarily be completely vulnerable. And other times, you may have people who are almost strangers to you. So how do you create that sense of safety in that relationship?
Well, those sort of things, as I briefly indicated, those wouldn't be out of the gate questions or explorations. It'd be something where there was this sense of established trust in the relationship and it would already demonstrated the safety of it. Safety is such a huge factor. It was another thing I had on my list, but opted to pass over just for the sake of time. But if safety isn't present in any relationship, by the way, the only really way we grow significantly in any relationship, marriage, friendship, in parenting, is there's got to be a high level of safety. So about establishing that, the thing that I've found does it best is I'll be the one that starts risking first. So bearing in mind that mentoring is about the mentee, not the mentor, I will still risk some kind of confession or something where I'm telling about some struggle I have, some thorn in the flesh or some nevertheless, and maybe hinting how I've navigated that or dealt with that through my life as a kind of a way of testing the water with somebody about their kind of willingness to open up, et cetera. Obviously, at some point we're going to get bitten on these relationships. I have a more Barnabas relationship with one of my female colleagues, and I felt a while back that something I had shared in confidence, I got bit on. And so now I'm very, very cautious about it. But usually you've got a pretty good sense this person is going to be trustworthy and hold this in confidence. Because those are deep things. I mean, we're talking about stuff that it just is with us. And we'd beg God, and we had, you know, like I say, we've had healing sessions and been anointed with oil and all of that, and yet there it is. And so, you know, to sort of speak that forth, because we're talking something pretty close to identity, in a weird way, where this is not something I'm going to, you know, build more spiritual disciplines into, and now I'm suddenly kind of I've triumphed over it, and I can give you stirring testimonies about how I overcame this. This is not a thing I overcome. It's a thing I live with and depend on God to not succumb to. So that's pretty tender stuff. And so that's where I'm, and not all my mentoring relationships go there. We keep it sort of safe on the, here's the lists, virtue lists in Paul or Peter, or whatever. What are you thinking that you'd most like to grow in this season? And then we look at that. It would be those ones where I felt a safety that we could sort of step over into that deeper realm.
I just have another question that I'd be interested to hear your thoughts on is, particularly from your experience as a pastor, what would you say would be the difference between a discipling relationship and a mentor relationship? Maybe you could sketch that out a bit.
Yeah, Evan, in some ways they have a large similarity, especially around those deep work things. Mm. that I talked about. I think that's also the deep work of discipleship. And I think that our neglect generally in our programmatic approaches to discipleship have not attended to those things of the you are the son, the adoption, etc. So I think that they share that in common. I think where you get to the practical work, that's when they start to separate out. Where I really do see discipleship is largely about what a follower of Christ believes and what a follower of Christ does, or really the theology or doctrine and the ethical obligations stemming from therein. And whereas that may be tangential to, in the mentoring relationship, and where actually programmatic elements to discipleship are more effective than sometimes the mentoring piece to programatize it. Though, again, I think if we don't attend to that deeper work in both, that many of our efforts won't really bear much fruit. So I think a lot of our discipling programs aren't bearing much fruit because we think if I just teach them the obligations of faith and practice, that will make them a disciple. And I think that, again, in the voice of, in the head of many people is a voice, if you are, and you got that voice is the loudest voice in your head, then all of your doing good things and learning good things is going to be in service of that performance. And I think that will skew it.
Because of my retirement, it really kind of brought up the whole idea of succession planning, and Moses and Joshua is such a great story there. And I wonder, as pastors, how do we impart that to pastors today to think about this succession planning? Certainly in our Baptist world, over 35 years in pastoral ministry, I don't feel we have done a very good job of it. And so it seems to me there's some real lessons there from Moses, Joshua, in that kind of mentor succession. Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, a few, Terry. That's such a good question. I think most succession plans are profoundly flawed. First of all, most of them are too long, way too long. And I think at the heart of them, if we really got honest, is we're trying to replicate ourselves in this next person, rather than identify that there's some really core things that maybe God wanted to do in and through me in this place. And if we could identify those core things, and you with your personality and gifts could sort of attend to them. But too much of it is around this replication of ourselves, and especially around these qualities that, you know, so-and-so is a great preacher, we want a great preacher, et cetera. And so I think we bite ourselves in the backside on that one, because we take a long time to do it. And the person the failure rate's amazing in long succession plans. In fact, there seems to be evidence that if you just sort of say goodbye and let the board sort it out, that you're as likely, if not more likely, to have a good successor. So I have become, by the way, I was all over succession planning until I started to kind of look at the research on it. But I think attending to some of those stories, like the Moses and Joshua story, would be helpful, because I think what we had identified, that was a long tenure, that was a long kind of apprenticeship under Moses. And we can identify key moments where he seemed to be kind of learning some specific thing from Moses. But in some ways it wasn't the preparation the boy needed, because Moses was doing a ministry of maintenance. His whole 40 years of maintaining and trying to deal with grumbly people and budget issues and all of that. Whereas Joshua's in a whole new thing. It's on a bar. It's a crossing over thing. And it's now we're engaging in a whole new set of response, you know, opportunities and dangers and whatnot. And I've got to lead a people in a very different way from Moses did. So I wonder even if I think he pulls it off, but it doesn't get, it starts to go downhill pretty quick after that. So there's a sense of me that even, I don't want to critique, you know, the biblical model, but I wonder if, you know, something else could have been done or whatever. The Joshua or Elijah thing is very interesting to me, because it's sort of like there is a long sort of apprenticeship, but when the thing finally happens, you know, I'm retiring, whatever, and it's like, boom. So I don't know. I am more and more inclined toward that we attend to more what is the deep work that God's doing in this place, and maybe the mantle that we pass on isn't how I did that, but the values I had around that.
My, you know, one of my kind of reflections from the discussion earlier today was just the generous spirit that mentoring kind of captures and is required for us to keep nurtured in our own life. To, and the when you use the talked about the double blessing, and wanting that for the people that we're mentoring, and to see them go places we haven't gone, to experience things maybe we experienced or maybe we haven't experienced. I just love that, kind of the generosity of that idea.
All right. Well, I think our time is just about come to an end. I want to thank all of you for just joining in on this today, and just the richness of the experience of learning together around this role. So, Mark, thank you. And to Rob, Terry, Evan, thank you very much for staying on for this, and very much appreciate your time.